this evening. If we look at all the blessings that flow from God, we consider that we are truly and greatly blessed by our Creator. We've been studying in Ecclesiastes as we've had the opportunity, and the last study we had was in the third chapter. In the first verses of the chapter, it says that for everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die. And then following that, there is a list of many other things, a time to plant, a time to pluck what is planted, and so on. Until the end of that list, in verse 9 of Ecclesiastes 3, Solomon says, "What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I've seen the God-given task which the sons of men, with which the sons of men are occupied. He has made everything beautiful or appropriate in its time. And also he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. God is the fountain whence 10,000 blessings flow. He is the giver of life and the giver of the enjoyment of life. If we but recognize that, then we see that the things we undertake to do, the plans and purposes which we have for our futures, are nothing unless they are centered around the God who created us and the Christ who died for us." Beginning in verse 16 of this chapter of Ecclesiastes, the third chapter, looking back at the fact that God has all things in His control, and that there is bad mixed with good, and good with bad, yet knowing that still it is in the hand of God, and that if life is to have its true meaning to us, then we must recognize that and have faith in Him. From verse 16 on through the end of this chapter, and on into the fourth chapter, there are questions. Questions about life. Questions about what one would see and do, and inconsistencies that might be perplexing. In verse 16, for example, he says, "Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there." The fact is that whenever God's laws are ignored or willfully violated, then injustice will replace justice, and iniquity will replace righteousness. Man, when left to himself, will become a wicked being because he chooses one wickedness which leads to another, which leads to another. We see this in the experiences of people. When they have turned away from God, they begin little moves slightly away from what God would have them to do. Those little moves become larger as time would go on, until you find a race of people, a group of people, a nation or more, serving themselves rather than God. And so it is not unheard of then, and therefore understandable, that in the place of judgment you might find wickedness, and in the place of righteousness you might find iniquity. It was true then, it's true now, far more than we might wish. I said in my heart, in verse 17, the writer says, "God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, and there shall be a time there for every purpose and for every work." The comforting thing for the person who believes God is that he knows, even though there is wickedness now, and even though there is an abuse of judgment, there will come a time of righteous judgment. And for those who choose their own way, and selfishly serve themselves rather than God, the righteous judgment of God will not overlook them. And for those who by continuing and patiently in doing the will of God in righteousness, for them there is a reward that may seem beyond focus at the moment when wickedness and iniquity prevail. Still, it is in the hand of God. And at that time of judgment, then there is the deliverance. I said in my heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, God tests them that they may see that they themselves are like beasts. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to the beast. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. That surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and all return to the dust. As you look at life from just a physical standpoint, how things are, where we've come from and where we're going, and you see oppression of the poor and the weak, and you see in the place of judgment wickedness, in the place of righteousness iniquity, and this continues on, is there any purpose? Is there anything to it? Well, there is the lesson to everyone that when left simply to ourselves and totally to ourselves, there's no difference between a man and an animal. As one dies, so the other dies. And as he says in verse 20, all go to one place. But as the poet said, from dust thou art, to dust returneth, was not spoken of the soul. The view of this line, or this expression here in Ecclesiastes, is excluding the thought of the soul. And when we think of man as but a beast, he is acting in a beastly manner. And so the soul of man is lost from view. Wickedness and inconsiderate and inconsiderateness and injustice. He is no better. Verse 21 asks a question then. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirit of the beast, which goes to the earth? How could you know by observation, some empirical knowledge, that the spirit of man goes upward and the beast goes down to the earth? How could you know the difference? By observing. You couldn't. You do not see that just by observation there is this distinct difference. But what makes the difference is that which is stated in Genesis 1, when God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. And that unique distinction that possesses man, that is made in the image of God. And knowing what God has revealed about us and about himself tells us that indeed there is a difference. And that indeed the truth completely known will help us to understand that the beasts act as they do out of instinct, and man can act as he must out of learning from the Creator and imitating the same. So I perceived that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for this is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? Now Solomon in all of this is saying that when you stop and stand back away from things, then you can see things the way they need to be seen, the way the truth would reveal them. But as you are yourself in the picture and you see inconsistencies and problems here that are that you wonder why. How could they be deserved by these? You are unable to perceive to answer the question of why. Step back and look at the whole picture. The view of life from more of a divine perspective. Remembering that God has the things in His hand. He has the control and will never give it up. Then, amidst all of this, in just simply viewing life under the sun, there's nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own work. For this is his heritage. As it said earlier, in verse 13, it is the gift of God. God makes it possible. God gives that as His gift. So, while there may be questions and wondering on your part, why? Remember your relationship to God. We're going into the fourth chapter. And the question continues. Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. In this month's Reader's Digest, there's the book section in the magazine is titled Against All Hope. And I want to read just the first sentence or two. That's a summary of the book. This is the prison memoirs of Armando Valladares. Armando Valladares was 23 years old, an entry-level government employee in Havana, when he made the mistake of speaking out against communism. For this crime, he spent 22 years in the hell of a Cuban gulag, starved, tortured, threatened with execution as a political prisoner of Fidel Castro. His book is a grim story of long years of suffering. I can't conceive the idea. I cannot understand because of my limited experiences. But those who have been political prisoners such as he, or small children, innocent children who are abused by uncaring and certainly unloving adults, or victims of crime and oppression of others. Solomon is writing about that. When he says, then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. It's there. It was there hundreds of years ago. It's there in our time. Some worse than others, but it's there. People are oppressed, and we may be oppressed. Jesus spoke of it as a distinct and real possibility for His disciples. Solomon says, and look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there was power, but they have no comforter. There's power. The oppressors are the ones with the power. They are the ones who are in control. They are the ones who hold others under their hand, under their thumb. And there's no comforter. And what question do you ask when such is the case? The one question that is most commonly asked, the one question it seems to me that Solomon is asking, is why? And in writing this, he is actually saying why, or another reason, why a person cannot gain his own happiness. You cannot depend solely on your own doing, on your own accomplishments, on your own power to gain happiness. Power, in this case, is on the side of the oppressors. In verse 2 he says, therefore I praise the dead who are already dead, more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. What's he saying? He's saying because of such bad conditions, it would be better to be dead already, or better yet, never to have existed. Never to be alive. And if we are not willing to fear God and keep His commandments, and if we are not able to see the control that God has, even though to us it seems that completely power is on the side of the oppressors, if we're unable to see that actually power is on the side of God, power is in His hands, and He controls even those who oppress others. But if we're unable to see that and unwilling to fear before Him, then verses 2 and 3, thinking that it's better to be dead or better yet, never to have lived, that seems very reasonable to us. There have been a number of examples like this in the Scriptures where these kinds of conditions existed and where these same kinds of questions are being asked. One of them is in Psalm 73. I'd like to read with you the first 12 verses of Psalm 73. Truly God is good to Israel, to such as are pure in heart, is His beginning. But notice how He follows this. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped, for I was envious of the boastful, when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no pangs in their death, but their strength is firm. They are not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like other men. Therefore pride serves as their necklace. Violence covers them like a garment. Their eyes bulge with abundance. They have more than heart could wish. They scoff and speak wickedly concerning oppression. They speak loftily. They set their mouth against the heavens and their tongue walks through the earth. Therefore His people return here and the waters of a full cup are drained by them. And they say, how does God know? And is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the ungodly who are always at ease. They increase in riches. The writer is saying, why? I was envious of the boastful. I saw the prosperity of the wicked. Why? Why is power on them? Why is prosperity on their side? In Jeremiah, the same kind of question is asked. The same kind of problem. In Jeremiah 12, in verse 1, righteous are You, O Lord, when I plead with You. Yet let me talk with You about Your judgments. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why are those happy who deal so treacherously? He was troubled. He didn't understand. So he asked God, why? Why is it so? The book of Habakkuk, to a large extent, the book is of this nature. In the first chapter, in verse 13, Habakkuk 1, verse 13, You are of purer eyes than to behold evil, and cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously, and hold your tongue when the wicked devours one more righteous than he? Habakkuk saying, why, Lord? Why? But I'd like you to look at these passages again. In Psalm 73, we read the first 12 verses where he describes the prosperity, the power of the wicked, how it looked good for them. But when you get to verse 17, he is saying, until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I understood their end The writer needed to come to God and ask the questions, but he from God would get answers. I came to the sanctuary of God. I drew close to God to find out. Then I knew their end. Then I knew that though everything seemed to be on the side of the oppressors, the wicked, it really wasn't. God would bring their end. Again in Habakkuk, in chapter 2 and verse 20, he makes the statement, "For the Lord is in His holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before Him." We sometimes sing that in our worship. The idea of it is, you've got to know who God is. You've got to know where He is, in His holy temple. Above all, His Word must be respected and honored. Let all the earth keep silence before Him. In the third chapter of Habakkuk, in verse 17 and 18, he says, "Though the fig tree may not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, though the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no fruit or no food, though the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord, I will joy in the God of my salvation." Even though I can look at life in a bleak time, a time of oppression, a time of suffering, when injustice and iniquity seems to have the upper hand, even though I can look at life in such an event as that, I can still and must still see God to be in control and rejoice in the Lord. What is good for man to do, even in times of oppression? Rejoice in the Lord. And again I say, rejoice. That's what Paul wrote in the book of Philippians. Paul the prisoner wrote that. The man who had been cheated, the man who had been falsely accused, the man who was a prisoner because he was a Christian, living in a time when to him, and as far as his personal needs were concerned, power was on the side of the oppressors. From prison he would write, "Rejoice. Rejoice in the Lord always. And again, rejoice." That was the message of the Lord Himself in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5. "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And the last of the Beatitudes was, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Rejoice, he is saying. Happiness belongs to you. Not if you just look at life here, apart from God, not able to see that God controls life and controls even the wicked. But if you do see that, then you can rejoice. Well, in verse 4, there's another problem presented. "Again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for wind." Now you see life, you look at life from another point of view, and you see people in competition. And you see a neighbor working hard and gaining a good living and prospering, and his neighbor hates him because he's been prosperous. He is envied. And so his happiness is taken away because others do not rejoice with him, whom he thought might be happy for him. So then another question. Well, if that's the case, then why not just stop laboring? Just forget it all. Well, the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Better is a handful with quietness than both hands full, together with toil and grasping for the wind. He's saying even if and even though there may be envy, competition that would diminish the rejoicing, the happiness that might otherwise be there, the answer is not to become idle. That's foolish. To become lazy, that's truly foolish indeed. In Proverbs 24, in verses 30 through 34, the writer says, I went by the field of the slothful, and by the vineyard of the man devoid of understanding, and there it was, all overgrown with thorns. Its surface was covered with nettles, its stone wall was broken down. And when I saw it, I considered it well. I looked on it and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. So your poverty will come like a prowler, and your want like an armed man. In Proverbs 15, verse 16 and 17, the answer to this, the best course of action is the happy medium between competition and always being envious and in competition with the neighbor. And on the other hand, or the other extreme, just, well, I'm not going to be in competition, so I won't do anything. The happy medium between that. Working diligently, the thing that's good. Proverbs 15, verse 16 and 17, he says, better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure with trouble. Better is a dinner of herbs with love, where love is, than a fatted calf with hatred. It's contentment, isn't it? You can be content with the fruit of your labor, the amount of which is relatively insignificant. You can be content with the food you eat, the nature of which, the kind of which may be relatively insignificant. Better is a handful with quietness, as the reading in Ecclesiastes 4, than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. Then in verse 7, then I returned and saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone without companion. He is neither son nor brother. Yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. Now he describes another person, another outlook on life. This person says, well, the way I'll be happy, the way that I'll find success is by just working for myself. And I'm going to exclude others. They're not important. The one that is important is me. And I work and I save and put by for me. The miser. That fellow who thinks that life is important only for himself finds that, in fact, all the money in the world cannot take the place of someone who could rejoice with him, a person with whom to share life, a person with whom to rejoice, with whom to have sorrow, with whom to have his experiences, good and bad. And those who isolate themselves from others find themselves wishing for something that is not there because they've made that choice. So in opposition to that, beginning in verse 9 and on through verse 12, he describes how beneficial a friend can be. Two are better than one because they have good reward for their labor. If two are working on a job, they can get more done together, working together. If they fall, one will lift his companion up. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. The benefit of having companions. The benefit in helping one another, of being close to one another, of caring about one another, just from a pragmatic or practical point of view. Beginning in verse 13, we see how the preacher, as the name Ecclesiastes is taken from, the writer, being Solomon, has shown the vanity of putting trust in wisdom, in pleasure, in labor, just for the sake of labor, and building things and doing things, in wealth, riches. Now he will show in these last few verses of the fourth chapter how empty it can be and how transient it can be to work for and attain a high position, whether it's in government or in business or whatever form or place in life. Better is a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. For he comes out of a prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. Now what's the idea? The picture here. Here's an old king who served as king. He has attained this place of honor, a success. But he can't live forever. And the time comes for a young, strong king to come and take his place. And he may not come from royalty. He may come from poverty, but that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if the hordes of people, the multitudes, are praising and honoring him and giving him that place of honor. It doesn't make any difference where he came from. The honor is his, and the position is his, and the old king cannot say anything to put a stop to the course that would follow. But there comes a time when that young king becomes an old king. And that young king who had the multitude following him and giving him praise and honor, they'll turn away from him and give his place of honor to someone else. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this is also vanity and grasping for wind. If we have made success the main goal in life, and we have achieved that goal and lived in it for some time with some sense of satisfaction in it, the day will come when we will be replaced. And it will be a most bitter day in our lives. There's no one of us or of all men who is irreplaceable. But understanding that, we can fully then see that our acceptance does not have to be of men. And our purpose in life, in order for us to be someone and have purpose and have hope, does not have to be simply for what I can be in business or what I can be politically. But our purpose and our hope truly can be in something far greater. This is the message from Ecclesiastes. looking at life under the sun, life on earth, you see the inconsistencies. You see the power on the side of oppression. You see the fellow who works and then he's envied by his neighbor. And there's competition and friction between them. You see the fellow who chooses then instead to fold his hands and become lazy and irresponsible. You see the miser who is indeed miserable. And you see the successful businessman or politician who himself is miserable. All of whom have forgotten the most important entity in the creation, and that is the Creator. All of whom have been working and doing their things, whatever they are, for themselves, wanting fulfillment, wanting happiness, and not finding it because they did not know God. Now, when you leave tonight and you get up in the morning and you go to work tomorrow and you make the dollar for that day and the next and the next, you're not working simply for that dollar. Furthermore, you're not working for what that dollar can buy. You're not even working for the people for whom the dollar can buy things. Your family or friends. You're working in your honest labor and can rejoice and be happy in the product of your labor when you keep God in focus. And you work as a servant of the Lord, because that'll make you honest. It'll make you generous. It'll make you hardworking, diligent, and zealous. It'll make you all that you ought to be, because you're not centering your attention simply on yourself, but rather on the Creator who has given you the gifts which you want to enjoy. And you can enjoy them when you fear Him and keep His commandments. I wonder if there's someone here tonight who has not recognized the Creator and His Son and has not become obedient to Him, who is not a Christian and therefore still lives in the guilt of your sins. And yet someone who would recognize that need tonight, who would take this opportunity to turn your life around, to turn away from your sins and come and follow Him in obedience, fearing Him and working righteousness, as indeed that will make you acceptable with Him. If you need to obey the Lord, why not come while we stand and sing together?